Greetings, Earth explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the result is always positive. This program is dedicated to the exploration of the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or listening while at home or at work on your computer, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and where we might be going than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. For the next 3 hours, you will be traveling safely beyond the limits of mainstream science and religion. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. Next week, we hope to begin a series on new and alternative energy sources. Your emails have prompted me to search out an alum of my alma mater. I spoke with his staff recently, and we're trying to work out a way for him to appear on the program without causing global collapse in the price of oil. When I was in college, we had a fleet of city buses that operated in town. It ran on hydrogen. Although the fog was a little prominent during the winter months, they used no carbon fuel and had no safety incidents. I was convinced back in 1975 that within 10 years, we would no longer be dependent upon fossil fuels for automobiles. Well, 31 years have passed, and still we do not have hydrogen power available for our cars and trucks. If you want to know why and how much longer we will have to wait until we stop using carbon fuels for transportation, you need to tune in to that program next week right here on X Squared Radio. We also want to let you know that very soon you will be able to receive X Squared Radio on your iPod. We will provide you the content, which you can download or you can stream it wirelessly from our site. We're still working through the details and the cost of bringing this to you, but whatever it is, it will be the best scientific talk radio on Earth. And we also want to put out a call to all POD or PDF authors. That includes publishers like Author House and Zulon and any other self-published author that has a story of space, time, human development, or mystery about ancient civilizations. If you have a story to tell, write us and tell us about it. If we can, we'll give you a forum from which you can tell your story and try to get you started in affecting the universe. We will also add our presence to your publication with our online store. We are going to try to do something that has never been done before to help keep people reading and supporting authors, because we need your creations. If you're interested in the X Squared Radio Profit Sharing Program as an author and you fit into our easy guidelines, then drop us a note at x2-radio.com. Also, Wednesday of next week, I will be completing my contribution to the world-class documentary called The Horizon Project. The first DVD will be available from their website at horizonproject.com, or you can follow the link at X Squared Radio. If you like watching the History Channel or the Science Channel, you are going to love these DVDs. Brent Miller is the writer and director, well, patented electrical engineer. We'll bring more of that to you next week. Tonight, the solar wind is a mere 295 kilometers per second. Sunspot number 365 is visible from Earth today, and there's a fair-sized coronal hole facing us. This time, the Earth will feel no real ill effects, as it is rather small but developing. You might see some lights in the northern sky tonight or tomorrow night. The full moon is on the 14th, as is usual, just before Passover. Tonight's guest is Nick Pope. Nick Pope used to run the British government's UFO project at the Ministry of Defense. Initially skeptical, his investigation of newly reported UFO incidents and access to government files on the subject soon convinced him that the phenomenon raised important national security issues. especially when the witnesses were military pilots or where UFOs were tracked on radar. He also looked into other mysteries such as alien abductions and crop circles. We'll cover all of those tonight. He now continues his research in a private capacity and is recognized as a leading authority on UFOs and the unexplained. He has done extensive media work, has lectured all around the world, and has acted as consultant on several TV documentaries. We are absolutely pleased to have him here with us tonight. Welcome, Nick Pope.
Hello, it's great to be on the show.
Well, I read so much that you sent me. I have to say, you're probably about the same age as I am. The subject of spacecraft and real UFOs, I guess they really didn't take off in this country until about the mid-50s or maybe early 60s after the Roswell and San Augustine crashes occurred. But then, the only contact I guess the general public had with the subject was in the movie theater. I know when I was a boy, I loved the Flash Gordon and even Gene Autry stories about the dealings with aliens. But have you always been interested in the subject of UFOs?
Not particularly, and that's, in a sense, I suppose, what makes my involvement with this quite interesting. I really fell into this whole subject almost by accident. I guess there were always a few science fiction books and films which had intrigued me. Reading The War of the Worlds when I was a child was an interesting experience, and watching films such as 2001, Close Encounters of the Third Kind and such like had intrigued me, but I really had no particular knowledge or experience of UFOs until I was just pitched into the subject quite really by chance when I was just given that particular job as part of my routine government work.
So you started out as a government employee, and then you were appointed into the Ministry of Defense?
I've always worked for the Ministry of Defense, and that's been pretty much my career. And I'm sure, in a way which is pretty constant all around the world in government service, you get moved around between different posts every few years, so you could do maybe a 2 or 3, maybe 4 year tour of duty somewhere, and then get posted to somewhere completely different. And I moved around a number of different, vastly different jobs. And then in 1991, I was told that my next tour of duty was going to be running the British government's UFO project.
Was there always a door at the Ministry of Defense with a UFO investigator on it, or did they just create it about that time?
No, it's the project has existed in one form or the other pretty much since about 1950 onwards.
Wow.
And an interesting piece of history, the Ministry of Defense here in Britain first got into the whole subject as a direct result of the intervention of our chief scientific advisor, the great scientist, the great radar pioneer, Sir Henry Tizard. And after the First World War, after the Second World War even, out by a few years there, after the Second World War, Winston Churchill brought Sir Henry Tizard back into government to try and shake up the post-war handling of science in the Ministry of Defense, and he was actually the Ministry of Defense's chief scientific advisor. And in 1950, he was looking at some of these reports of UFOs that had been coming in, and he said, well, you know, we shouldn't dismiss all this without some form of proper scientific study. So he set up a group which went by the name of the Flying Saucer Working Party. Wonderful title, I think. Far more imaginative, maybe, than Project Blue Book.
Yeah, I think so. It kind of tells what the organization does.
Well, exactly. And the Flying Saucer Working Party, it existed for the best part of a year, and its conclusions were fairly skeptical. and it said, well, I think most of these things can be explained away as misidentifications of ordinary objects and phenomena, hoaxes, psychological delusions, and such like, and it recommended no further action. But as ever, the real world intervened, and a series of very interesting encounters where UFOs were seen by military personnel and tracked on radar in the early 50s soon brought the Ministry of Defense back into the game, as it were.
And so it's just about the time they think they've closed the file on it as a bunch of crackpots and weirdos. And I know in some of the information that you sent me, we had sightings going all the way back to 1896 where airships were seen doing high-speed maneuvers, but obviously no Ministry of Defense around to investigate it. But
sure.
So about the time they're ready to close the book, here they show up again.
Exactly, and as ever, the one thing that dictates your policy on all this is events. And events, the real world intervened, and the Ministry of Defense couldn't really extricate itself from this subject because these things were being seen by pilots, they were being chased in fast jets, our Air Force was finding themselves getting called out, scrambled, fighter controllers were vectoring them towards UFOs, the pilots were seeing these things, and they were completely running rings around them. And in those sorts of circumstances where the objects were displaying speeds and maneuvers that even our Air Force couldn't match, the Ministry of Defense really couldn't agree with the earlier conclusions of the Flying Saucer Working Party, that this was all just nonsense. And we've had a UFO project in one way, shape, or form pretty much ever since.
And that occurred when? That started in the mid-50s?
That was the Flying Saucer Working Party was set up in 1950 and reported in 51. But just when they thought, just when they recommended no further action, around about 1952, 53, that's when these events started to really take off. And from then onwards, the Ministry of Defense has had this UFO project.
Well, what do you think made the subject of UFOs a national defense issue and not maybe a public relations action?
Simply the fact that that our what we call here the United Kingdom's air defense region, but effectively our airspace was being intruded upon. And the department took no view on what these things were, so there was no corporate belief in extraterrestrials. But it was simply a statement of fact that these unknown objects, whatever they were, terrestrial, extraterrestrial, some sort of other unknown phenomena, we just didn't know. But they were here. They were being tracked on radar. They were being seen frequently by reliable witnesses, such as pilots, police officers, military personnel. And it was simply a question of something that couldn't be ignored. But when there's something in your airspace, and when that something is unidentified but displays speeds and maneuvers apparently well in excess of the best aircraft in your inventory, that makes it automatically a defense and national security issue.
Well, I can see that it would. In your investigations, when you say that these things were tracked on radar, were they tracked coming in from some particular direction, or did they just come out of the sky, or did they just rise up and appear, or?
They, that's an interesting question. I mean, of course, our military radars are configured, certainly in Britain, predominantly for a particular scenario, and that dates back to the Cold War, and of course the scenario that they're configured for is a conventional invasion involving aircraft coming in from the north and the east, during the Cold War, from the Soviet Union, and before that, of course, from Germany. So, of course, that's the way that our air defenses are configured. That's where, predominantly, they're looking. So, inevitably, we're not really looking, and perhaps this is an interesting point in itself, they're not looking for something coming straight down from outside the atmosphere. They're looking for something coming in a conventional sense from predominantly the north and the east. Now, what that means, in effect, is that when a UFO shows up, whatever it, wherever it comes from, they just suddenly appear. And I've spoken to fighter controllers and air traffic controllers who talk about looking at the screen, and suddenly a blip will just appear as if something has maybe come from nowhere. But perhaps, of course, that's because it's come from straight down, but our radars aren't really configured to see that. I say that there's one exception to that, of course, and that's the space tracking radars that the ballistic missile early warning sensors have. Now, we have one in the United Kingdom at an Air Force base called Fylingdales, and, of course, there's a network of these radars around the globe. And my investigations would always sweep up the ballistic missile early warning sensor because, of course, I was interested to see whether the space tracking radar could pick anything out. But these things, whatever they are, apparently, sometimes they're just capable of being completely stealthy. But then that doesn't surprise me. I mean, there's no great secret. We can do stealth, so...
Yeah, I don't know how many aircraft can just go stealthy at will and then just all of a sudden choose to be scanned, choose to appear on the screen.
Well, that's interesting, though, because in a sense, the 117 and the B-2 can do that. In that, for example, when the bomb bay doors open, you'll get a radar return.
Yeah, there's a new reflection there.
Yeah. So, to a certain extent, just changing your profile or doing something quite small can move you from a stealthy to a non-stealthy profile.
Well, these incidents, I guess, because of the advent of modern and reliable radar and radar networks, in the mid-50s, maybe they have always been appearing. We've had maybe rural reports, maybe a few eyewitnesses, but no real data. And then in the mid-50s, we began, you know, having the ability to sense them and record these sensations and network these sensations. Have the appearances of UFOs continued since that time?
Yes, very much so. But, you know, there's another interesting point about radar, which I'll just make because I think it's quite relevant. And that's, of course, the equipment is only one side of the story here. The other key thing is the training you give to the people that operate these systems. And again, if your training is configured on looking for conventional aircraft behaving in conventional ways, when you have a non-conventional phenomena showing up on your radar screen, you'll be more inclined just to write it off as anomalous propagation, atmospheric effects, ghost in the machine, or whatever. I had a very interesting and revealing conversation with a colleague in the Air Force, and he was talking about, in fact, the place I was just mentioning, the Ballistic Missile Early Warning Center at Fylingdales, and he said, well, occasionally we track these fireballs, he said, just flying at incredible speeds of maybe 17, 18, 19, 20,000 miles an hour. And I just asked innocently, I said, well, how do you know they're fireballs? And the answer came back, because they go very fast. When you see, again, it's the mindset, it's the training. If you're not expecting a particular object or phenomenon, and if you're exclusively looking for aircraft and unmanned aerial vehicles, anything that doesn't fit the pattern is just outside your parameters. So I think sometimes the question is not do these things show up on our radar systems, but when they show up, are they properly recorded as such, or are they just ignored and almost edited out because of the way in which people are taught to analyze the data in front of them?
Well, is there an effort officially from the top down? I know in industry, when we see special causes or statistically anomalous things, if they occur more than once or twice, we begin to go back and put retraining into place or increase the ability of the sensing system to discriminate. Is there an effort from the top down to go back into these training methods and maybe even instrumentation methods and say, you know, gee, we're getting 200 or 300 or 400 sightings a year. We'd like a little more data on this, and maybe we're going to reconfigure our instrumentation or enhance it, and we're going to enhance our training. Is there an effort like that going on?
Well, that's exactly what should be happening, but sadly, to the best of my knowledge, at present is not happening. I think one of the problems is, of course, the labeling. If you talk about any of this in terms of UFOs, people's belief systems, very often skeptical ones, will come into play, and people will say, well, I think we have better things to use our time and resources on than a UFO hunt.
Yes, I'm aware of the science or the religion of science. We run into that in this country all the time as well. However, perhaps in the science of physics, we get a little bit fringe when we talk about parallel universes and time warps and things like that. Some of the best physics minds on the planet have sort of vindicated that way of thinking. But I do run into that all the time when you interview men on the street about UFOs or alien races or visitors from another planet. They sort of look at you sideways like, gee, do I really admit what I know? And like you use the word belief, you know, you either believe in them or you don't believe in them. To me, it's kind of like believing in chemistry. You know, it's those not familiar with the science might be skeptical, but chemistry is very real, and perhaps these things are very real as well.
Yes, I'd agree with that, and I think it's not all bad news, and certainly over the years there have been many senior people here in Britain, both in politics and in the military and in intelligence, who have been prepared to look with an open mind at this. If anything, there's, I suppose, you could talk, and I've used this phrase myself on occasion, a skeptic versus believer debate on the UFO phenomenon raging at the heart of the establishment. And it is a debate that's drawn in some extraordinarily high-profile figures in Britain over the years, two very prominent people who believed in an extraterrestrial reality were Lord Dowding and Earl Mountbatten. More recently, the Chief of the Defence Staff, Lord Hill Norton. And he went on after his tour of duty as Chief of the Defence Staff. He chaired NATO's military committee. This is a five-star Navy officer, and quite forthright in his belief, not only in extraterrestrial presence here on Earth, but a government cover-up as well. So some extraordinarily high-profile people have over the years spoken out on this, about their belief. So there are sometimes people who are prepared to look. Sadly, of course, a lot of this interest comes after their retirement.
Yeah, we have a similar effort in this country headed up by Dr. Stephen Greer called the Disclosure Project. And they're, most of the people that are contributing are those who have worked in and around or with this technology, been exposed to alien technology, and now at the end of their days they're sort of coming out of retirement and saying, yes, I worked with this, or yes, I saw this. And it would be very nice if someone contemporary would come out with that. But you know, when you say you were thrust into this sifting of data and testimony and trying to gather and collect and maybe help formulate the government's posture on this subject. How did that change your life? Did your relationships with people change? Did you make yourself available to the public, or did you just handle information in a clerical way for government representatives, or were you independent of other agencies? How did it change you?
Well, during the 3 years that I was actually on this project, my involvement was really entirely internal to the Ministry of Defence. Now, that said, of course, I would get reports from both military and, of course, the public, and indeed in terms of the statistics, most of the 200 or 300 reports that I received each year were ones that had come from the public. But it's kind of hard to put a typical day together because there really wasn't one. I might be investigating a new sighting that had come in. I might be drawing up some lines for the press office to deal with an inquiry from the media. I might be dealing with correspondence from one of our political representatives raising the subject on behalf of a constituent, or I might even be helping with a letter that had come in from a school child doing a project on the subject. So you could have this extraordinary range of stuff. One moment I could be dealing with investigating a sighting from a military pilot. The next minute I could be writing to a little boy saying, thank you for your letter concerning your school project on UFOs. So
it sure sounds like an absolutely fascinating position and the range of things that you would have to have dealt with in that.
Oh, project. It was the best job in the whole department. I've got no doubt about that.
Did you ever find yourself being sort of the subject of the news where the public is saying, well, there's a government cover-up and Nick Pope is involved in it, or...
Yes, that did happen, inevitably. Because particularly under freedom of information, but I mean the general principle that we did try to be helpful. This wasn't a secret project, and of course many of the things that we'll probably talk about can be actually seen on the Ministry of Defence's website now. Inevitably my name got out into the public domain even whilst I was doing that job. And yes, both with the media and with particularly some of the UFO researchers, there was a little bit of, well, here's the man behind the cover-up.
Did anybody come and snatch you up at 1 o'clock in the morning saying, hey, you've got to come and see this?
No, fortunately, out of hours, we had permanent manning around an office called the Air Force Operations Room, and they would deal with anything on the Air Force side that happened out of office hours, whether it was a UFO report by someone at night or whether it was an aircraft stuck halfway around the world without diplomatic clearance to fly onwards. So I didn't get woken up too many times.
Well, did you receive any information or that was kept classified and kept secret? I know most of us here in the U.S. believe the government, our government, keeps all kinds of secrets from us about alien presence. Is there anything that the British government's holding back?
Well, inevitably there was some classified data that crossed my desk, yes, but there was nothing. There was nothing that I saw that led me to believe that the British government was in any way involved with a cover-up or a conspiracy to keep the truth of this from the public. I mean, I saw no evidence that we had any recovered vehicles or bodies or anything like this. I'm aware, and I was aware at the time, of the stories and the theories in the literature, but I saw nothing to validate that. Now, you could argue that might mean a number of things. It might mean, as I believe, that the British government is not covering up this information. But, of course, conspiracy theories say it might just simply mean that I didn't have a high enough security classification, that I was out of the loop, or indeed that the British government is out of the loop, and that this is exclusively a in terms of an extraterrestrial reality and presence, something that the American government is handling. The honest answer is I simply don't know.
Well, I kind of, my personal feeling is that maybe if they are extraterrestrials and they're coming here, we've sort of always assumed it would be, you know, sort of take me to your leader. But it wouldn't necessarily be that way. They would not necessarily interact with heads of state or even bother with the governments. And although, at least in my research, in the free world, it appears as though the UK and the US are the only ones that are collecting a lot of information on UFOs. But certainly they can't be the only countries in the world that are having these encounters.
Oh, no, I'm aware both from the literature and from the media that, of course, as you say, this is, in terms of the sightings and in terms of the experiences, this is truly a global phenomenon. But I've seen no evidence that the British government is involved in a cover-up, and in fact, I would say that, in a sense, the British government and the military, since 1950, has been itself searching for answers on this, but without success.
That is amazing that you know, all the people that we have on this planet and all the work that has been done in so many different areas, so many different kinds of sciences, so many telescopes and radars and radio telescopes out there listening, that we can't seem to nail down such a global phenomenon. Of course, you know, with superior technology may come a rather routine and well understood way to evade all of that. But I think, I guess, in the last 50 years, because of our instrumentation, because of our fear of one another as countries, we went through a period of the Cold War where we were just watching each other intensely for any kind of movement, and it was sort of a cat and mouse game for 30 years as global superpowers balanced their power and tried to avoid war while still maintaining their sovereignty. But going back and thinking about how the Ministry of Defense, you know, was originally formed in a time of war, and that footing, that mentality, were there any inspirations, I guess, to the British government to start them getting involved with UFOs? I know in going through your research, I ran across the very famous Professor R.V. Jones. What influence did he have in getting things started in that direction?
Well, R.V. Jones was quite a skeptic on the UFO phenomenon, and in many ways he was a counterweight to some of the people like Tizard and later on Dowding and Mountbatten, who thought that this was worth looking at. And Professor R.V. Jones was very much, I think, the skeptic on this. But R.V. Jones was somebody who really got into looking at the whole related issues of Foo Fighters and ghost rockets. Now, Foo Fighters, as you and listeners may know, were these balls of light, but I'll go on to qualify that a little later, balls of light seen by aircrew during the Second World War. I say balls of light, that's the typical description of this, but if you drill down into the data of this, you'll see that it's not just balls of light, and I've seen some Foo Fighter reports that talk about immense metallic craft. So these things were seen, and of course we were very concerned about them, because we thought that these might be some new Nazi weapon. And after the war, it turned out that the Axis nations of Germany and Japan had seen these sorts of things too, and had made the reverse assumption that this was some sort of British or American secret weapon.
Kind of an interesting game, isn't it, when you have so much fear on both sides and everybody says, hey, what was that? They must have some new kind of weapon. Did they ever get involved with the military air operations? I know we had bomb raids going one way and the other. We had fighters trying to protect the channel, and we had reconnaissance going. But, you know, in World War II, we were limited to, what, about 20, 25,000 feet in altitude, and everybody's standing around looking out a 50-degree below zero window through goggles. Did they ever get involved with the military operations, or were they just sightseeing?
There didn't seem to be any interaction, which was quite interesting, because people, the air crew, would talk about these objects just showing up and almost shadowing the aircraft. There was no interaction. There was certainly no engagement on either side. And again, I guess that's interesting. And then in the period after the war, there were these other sightings of these so-called ghost rockets, which at first, again, the assumption was that we were dealing with some sort of Soviet rocket, some sort of advanced technology, maybe something they'd gotten from the Germans. Of course, we'd had operations such as Paperclip, and we thought that with people like Wernher von Braun, we'd gotten most of the top Nazi rocket scientists. So when these ghost rocket sightings there was this fear that perhaps somebody had gotten some sort of technology that we'd missed. But
when we think about rockets here, I mean, what goes up must come down. We think of something launched from some place on the ground to another place on the ground, and, you know, landing in pieces or blowing up. These rockets, were they going out into space? Were they just streaking across the sky and then disappearing, or were they landing somewhere?
They were streaking across the sky. There were occasional rumors of crashes and things like that. And indeed, on one occasion, and this is actually documented in R.V. Jones's book about British scientific intelligence in the war, and immediately afterwards, a very famous book called Most Secret War. And there's a chapter in that book which most ufologists are not aware of, but it's a wonderful chapter called Swords into Plowshares, Bombs into Saucers. And it talks about the whole ghost rocket phenomena. And I mentioned R.V. Jones was skeptical, but he talks about an occasion where one of these craft was apparently recovered, or rather debris was recovered and taken back to the Royal Aircraft Establishment at Farnborough. It was very quickly recovered by scientific and technical intelligence specialists. Now, it turned out that this was not debris from anything extraordinary at all. I mean, something might have crashed in the area, but somebody had just picked up some pieces of industrial debris.
Ah, I see.
But it's interesting that what it says about how quickly and secretly this debris was actually secured. In this case, I believe from Sweden, a neutral country, which posed some interesting diplomatic issues in itself, and how quickly and eagerly the world of scientific and technical intelligence got its hand on this.
Yeah, the fact that the intellectual infrastructure was in place to cross borders and expedite an investigation like that implies that the government very much indeed had a very strong interest in investigating this.
Yes. And there's a long forgotten report of an alleged UFO crash in this marvelous book. And there's a story about a farmer who phoned up the Air Ministry, quote, to remove one of these darned contraptions which had fallen from the sky onto his farm.
That sounds perfect. And what happened?
Well, they tried to locate the farm, and they couldn't find it. So they'd written the whole thing off as a hoax. But quite extraordinary that for some reason they had the telephone numbers to get through to intelligence, and that they actually deployed individuals to try and locate this area.
Well, I find that very believable, because I myself have asked for directions in the country, in the countryside, and not found what I was looking for either. Of course, my wife was mad at me because I didn't stop and ask for directions, but hey, that's just the way we are over here. I read in your information that in May of 1955, an interesting month because that's the year and month I was born, an American journalist, Dorothy Kilgallen, wrote of a crash UFO story she allegedly overheard at a cocktail party hosted by the man you already mentioned, Earl Mountbatten. Earl, is it Earl of Mountbatten, or is it...
No, just Earl Mountbatten.
Okay. And the excerpt from that story is, British scientists and airmen, after examining the wreckage of one mysterious flying ship, are convinced these strange aerial objects are not optical illusions or Soviet inventions, but are flying saucers which originate on another planet. How was her report viewed by the British Ministry of Defense?
Well, I think with a degree of embarrassment and skepticism, my own theory is that there's possibly a link between this story and the story that I just mentioned that R.V. Jones talks about in his book. And I believe, I mean, this is sometimes referred to as the Westerham incident. And Westerham is a place in Kent where this alleged crash took place. And I believe that if this story of this crash was known to R.V. Jones and was known to technical intelligence, then the story would have got around to the very senior government figures such as Mountbatten. So maybe these incidents are one in the same. Now, whether Dorothy Kilgallen was onto something, and whether this was there was more to it than R.V. Jones tells in his book, I don't know. But certainly, people like Mountbatten did believe in this, and indeed, there was an alleged landing that took place at Mountbatten's estate in Broadlands. Now, again, it's not clear whether this story is legitimate or not, but the fact is that he took a close personal interest in this and caused it to be properly investigated.
Well, it sounds like you have seen literally thousands of UFO appearances and evidence across your desk. What is the yearly average? Do you get one a day, or do they come in groups and spurts, like there'll be a sighting and you'll get 100 people call in at the same time, or how does that happen?
It averages out at about 200 or 300 reports each year. But that, of course, doesn't really give a true picture. There is, I think, massive under-reporting of this phenomenon, certainly in the UK, for a number of reasons. Firstly, the fear of ridicule, but secondly, the practical issue that nobody really knows. If you were to stop someone in the street and say, what would you do if you'd seen a UFO, people wouldn't automatically say, well, I'd phone the British government's UFO project. it's not that we were secret. It's not that you couldn't find us, but we didn't particularly advertise ourselves either. There is a document which talks about the policy is generally to downplay the subject. And again, that's a document that's been in the public domain for many years under the Freedom of Information Act. And I guess that sums it up fairly adequately. We react to these things, but we don't necessarily go and advertise our presence and actively go looking for them. Now, perhaps that's a mistake. Perhaps we should. Perhaps we'd stand a better chance of solving the mystery if we did. But you know, the other thing is that some people, if they do report a UFO, will go to the Ministry of Defence, but others might go to the media, or indeed to civilian UFO groups, such as in America, of course, places such as MUFON, but the British equivalents of these sorts of groups. So again, when I talk about the Ministry of Defence receiving 200 or 300 reports each year, I knew full well that many, many reports were passing us by.
Well, you know, a lot of these I would expect would come in by phone or by letter or even, you know, email. But in the last, in the last 5 years, the advent of digital photography, you know, being affordable and plentiful and available to people, I'm sure now the evidence that's coming in may be short digital films or digital photographs of, and it's a lot better than a phone call. Hey, I saw some silver thing in my backyard, and by the way, I took this excellent 5-megapixel picture of it, and here it is attached to this email. Are you getting that kind of evidence now with millions and millions of digital cameras out there watching?
Well, of course, I should stress, I'm not running the UFO project anymore. My interest now is in a private capacity, so I don't know what the government's getting on this, and I believe that the emphasis of the project has shifted from the research and investigation that I was doing during my tour of duty to now freedom of information, because believe it or not, Britain's Freedom of Information Act has only been fully in force for just over a year.
Really?
Yeah. I guess people sort of think that we must have had one for decades.
I guess people were lined up at the door when that thing passed.
Well, sure. And but the truth of the matter is that we've really only had it for just over a year. But the extraordinary thing about it is that if you go onto the Ministry of Defence's website, which is just mod.uk, and if you go into their Freedom of Information portal, you'll see that information on UFOs is amongst the most popularly requested subjects that people are after, both journalists, researchers, members of the public, whoever. And a lot of the UFO information is there right on the front page of the MOD's FOI page.
Huh.
Now, what this means is that, of course, all the people working where I used to work now spend all their time reacting to these requests for information, and that impacts, of course, adversely on any time they might have to investigate sightings that come their way.
Yeah, they've gone into the public relations business not by choice, but because of demand and legislation. So how does the UK's program, say, compare to, well, you mentioned Project Blue Book earlier. That was an Air Force department that was dispatched to investigate UFOs, and I don't even think they exist anymore.
Don't. They wound up in 1969 after the Condon report. But interestingly, the British government's UFO project, although we didn't have a formal title like Project Blue Book, the terms of reference were almost identical, as were the modus operandi. So how you do an investigation, as you would expect, doesn't really vary from country to country. You interview the witness, and you look at the evidence. But I'm conscious I haven't answered your last question about the digital film footage. And the answer to that is I don't know, but I'm pretty sure there are more and more good quality pictures coming in. But I think the critical point is going to happen in about 2 to 3 years. And, of course, this is the rise of people who have a digital camera facility on their cell phones. And I think that...
I just got one myself.
Ah, well, you see, when that technology is pretty all-pervasive in the country, and when the quality of this is good enough so that you can really get a good image and not a fuzzy one, then I think you will almost get pretty much the way you described it in your question. You'll almost get people say, I saw a UFO, and here's the image downloaded from my cell phone and emailed to you. And when we're in that situation, of course, we do have all sorts of specialists working at the Ministry of Defence and indeed elsewhere who really specialise in analysing and enhancing images. So, again, the evidence that we'll be looking at, I think, will be very interesting, and we'll have a better chance of drawing some meaningful conclusions. So I think it's...
All of this is working toward a at least a statement of a conclusion, and we will get to it in our next hour. But right now I'm going to take a couple of commercials. If you need a glass of water or something, we'll take about a four-minute break. I'll do some commercials, a short musical bumper, and then we'll be right back. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio. My guest tonight is Nick Pope, former employee in charge of UFO research for the Ministry of Defense. The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, 2012, and the Harvest of the End Times is now off the presses. It can be purchased everywhere online, but if you want an autographed copy, you need to order it from the website at arkofmillionsofyears.com. Make sure you spell that with a K, like Noah's Ark. If you have enjoyed Volume 1 of The Ark of Millions of Years, which clearly explained the creation of the Earth, you will need Volume 2 to explain why we are here and where we might be going from here. If you want to know where, say, the Ark of the Covenant is being held, or how the Sumerian language was found in Bolivia, or how ancient texts testify that off-worlders visited ancient peoples in South America, you need to read this book. My co-author, E.J. Clark, and I have for the first time uncovered information you have never seen before. There is no doubt that off-worlders have been involved with the development and recovery of mankind after a series of cataclysms. So get your copy today. You can go to Barnes & Noble or Amazon, or you can get your autographed copy at arkofmillionsofyears.com. Have you been to the Discovery Store lately? If you go to X Squared Radio, that's x2-radio.com, and click on the Discovery Store sign, you will be amazed at how easy it is to own the world's best telescopes. Everyone is excited about star and planet watching. Did you know that most of the comets named in the past 50 years were found by amateurs? On May 7th, the Schwassmann-Wachmann comet will pass in front of the Ring Nebula in the Lyra system. If you want to watch it for yourself, you can do it. Just go to the Discovery Store and get your telescope as soon as you can. Right now, you get free shipping with orders over $75. Who knows? You might save the planet or find the next great comet. So visit the Discovery Store at X Squared Radio. Are you interested in stuff for your space? Well, I just bought a leather hand-tooled map for my office that hangs on the wall. It's about 30 inches square. It's a 21st century Europe, and it has beautiful wood rods that hold its shape on the top and bottom. And it looks awesome next to my Egyptian papyrus paintings. They're on sale right now if you click the Novica link at X Squared Radio. In cooperation with National Geographic, You can find some of the best world art and sculptures and replicas at very good prices by visiting Novica at X Squared Radio. We will take a very short 48-second musical break and return with our guest, Nick Pope. I'm Brooks Agnew. And welcome back, Earth Explorers, to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew, and our guest tonight is Nick Pope. Served a commission in the Ministry of Defense in the United Kingdom, Britain, and we have had an amazing first hour, laid some great groundwork. I want to open this hour by talking about what many call Britain's Roswell incident, and this is an incident called the Rendlesham Forest UFO appearance. It has more than one credible witness, and I'll let you tell us the story, and I've got some details here we might want to cover. Go ahead.
Well, yes, this, as you say, it's Britain's Roswell. It's certainly the United Kingdom's most famous UFO event, and it's probably, speaking from my position as having run the MOD's UFO project, it's probably the event which gives us the most credible evidence that the UFO phenomenon may have a non-conventional explanation, or at least some UFO sightings.
Mm-hmm.
The story, in a nutshell, it's difficult. It's like, I guess, saying to someone, well, just sum up Roswell for us. And, of course, entire books have been written on this case. But very briefly, over a series of nights in December 1980, a UFO was seen next to United States Air Force bases here in England, RAF Bentwaters and RAF Woodbridge. On the first night, a guard patrol saw lights in the forest, and they thought that an aircraft might have crashed, so they went out to investigate. They didn't find a crashed aircraft. They found a UFO moving through the trees, and at one point, this thing actually landed. It touched down in a small clearing. There were three people in the patrol. These were United States Air Force security police officers. One of them got close enough to touch the side of this thing.
He said, that's pretty close.
Well, yes. He said it was like nothing he could describe, nothing within his field of experience.
Were there any markings on it?
Yes, there were. Strange markings, and the only thing that he could liken them to was Egyptian hieroglyphs. And he sketched these things, and a sketch that one of the witnesses made of the craft, and a sketch of these hieroglyphic markings, I've put both of those on my own website, which is nickpope.net, so listeners can go and take a look at these documents, which have been released under the Freedom of Information Act. people can go and take a look at these for themselves and see that sometimes the skeptics try and talk about this case in terms of unexplained lights. Well, I like to nail that lie. We're not talking about lights. We're talking about a craft. And the official documents make that quite clear. Now, of course, because this thing landed, we got all sorts of trace evidence that we normally wouldn't get. There were holes, there were marks, indentations in the ground where this thing had come to rest. Apparently, when we plotted this out, they formed a perfect equilateral triangle. So this thing was as it were on well, I use the word legs, but almost a tripod device of some sort, perhaps. And as you would expect, one of the things that people then did is the following day they went out to the site and they used a Geiger counter. They took some radiation readings. Those readings, when they were looked at in the Ministry of Defense by the Defense Intelligence staff, the Defense Intelligence staff said that the readings seemed significantly higher than background, by a factor of about 7. And again, for all the people who quite rightly want to see the original source of this, don't take my word for it. It's all on both my website, mickpope.net, and far more importantly, on the Ministry of Defense's website. So you can track this right back to the government file on MOD.net.
When you say these things were sketched, did he sketch it on the spot, or did he?
Yes, because he was security police. He had a notebook.
I see.
So he made a sketch of this. Now, far more controversially, some of the witnesses also claim that as well as a sketch, they took a photograph, but were told that the films hadn't come out properly.
Well, I would
think... I'd better not comment on that.
if it's in the nighttime, a lot of times, especially with film, you're not really going to get a great shot. But,
that's probably true, and also the fact that this thing was a very bright light source, so it was difficult circumstance under which to be taking any photographs. And the other thing, of course, is these people were scared. These were pretty young guys out in the middle of a forest at night encountering a UFO. They were pretty scared by their own admission, and who can blame them?
So did they jumped on their two ways, their radios, and called back to base and said,
well, there were difficulties with the communication. Now, this is interesting in itself, and I'll get, when I talk about the second night of the encounters, I'll talk about some other equipment that was malfunctioning. But whether it's something to do with the propulsion system of this craft, whatever it was, some sort of electromagnetic field, whether it was a product of the radioactivity that apparently this object was emanating, again, the truthful answer is, I just don't know. But it's interesting to speculate that this might have been responsible for the photographs not coming out and for the difficulty that these people had in radioing this back to base.
So while it was at rest on the ground, they, one of them at least, ran up and touched it, another one sketched it, and the lights were on the craft? Was did they report any kind of noise, or did anything come out of the craft? Any windows open or doorways open, or
no noises at all? No noise from it. No real sense of windows or anything like that. And again, I think the truthful answer is that this thing was so bright that they really couldn't make out too many of the details.
Mm.
Now,
did they hang around until it lifted off?
Yes, it moved away, and it rose up through the trees. It smashed smashed some of the branches off trees as it had come in, and again there was some damage to some of the trees, and it rose up fairly gently and then shot off at high speed. Now, as you can imagine, word of this soon got up the chain of command, and the person who took the closest interest in this was the deputy base commander, Lieutenant Colonel Charles Holt, and he was the one who ensured that all the witnesses to this wrote up their proper statements on United States Air Force forms, and caused everything to be properly looked into. But what he didn't expect was to be caught up in the incident himself. But that's exactly what happened, because the following night he was at a social engagement. There was a party on the base, and suddenly the door burst open and a young airman saluted to the colonel, and he said, "Sir, it's back." And Holt looked a bit confused, and he said, "What? What are you talking about? What's back?" And the airman said, "The UFO, sir, the UFO's back." Now, Holt was a skeptic. He knew that the people on the Penite had seen something, but he was certainly not a believer in extraterrestrials or anything like that. So he threw together a small team of people, and in his own words, this is quite interesting, he said, "I went out to debunk this," but he couldn't debunk it because he saw the UFO himself. And there's a tape recording of this, and again, you can track this down on the internet. He took with him a portable dictaphone, and he recorded his thoughts as he and his team approached the UFO, and at one point as the UFO approached him. And again, you can hear the tension in the voices of these United States Air Force witnesses as they encounter the UFO. And at one point, and I think this is extremely interesting, at one point the UFO was seen, when they were out in the forest, it was directly over the base, and it was firing beams of light down at the establishment. Now again, if something like that isn't of some defense significance, if something like that doesn't raise serious national security issues, I'm not sure what does.
I reckon. So here you are in a forest that lies in between two Air Force bases, which I guess, were they were run by Americans or were they run by British? Or
They were almost exclusively run by the United States Air Force. There was effectively just a British liaison officer there, and he, in fact, played a critical part in making sure that these sightings were reported not just to the United States Air Force, but, of course, to the British Ministry of Defense.
I'm just, my imagination is racing, because I'm thinking, if this thing shot off at high speed and, you know, made a speedy getaway, I guess, it just seems so odd that it would have come back to the same woods in between two Air Force bases, which I can guarantee you, I was in the Air Force. We had a small airplane that crossed over the Canadian border and flew over a corner of our base. Now, the base where I was stationed is Grand Forks, North Dakota, which is probably one of the highest security bases in the country. It's where Missile Command is based, and you just don't fly over that base. And turned around and flew back over the Canadian border, and I'm telling you, heads rolled. They were colonels out on the tarmac doing push-ups the next day, because everyone was in trouble. And I can tell you that both of those bases were on the highest alert after the previous night, and now here you have this thing appear again, and Lieutenant Colonel Charles Holt is out in the woods with his dictaphone witnessing this thing. This went to the highest levels. It may have gone to the president himself.
Well, I know for a fact, because I spoke to, and in fact I had dinner with, the base commander, now long since retired, but General Gordon Williams, and he was discussing this, and one of the interesting documents that, again, has been released under the Freedom of Information Act, showed that very shortly after this event, the critics of evidence of this, including things like the tape recordings, the Commander-in-Chief of United States Air Force in Europe, General Gabriel, made a special visit to the base and took possession of this evidence, and it was taken back to his headquarters at Ramstein in Germany.
I can imagine so.
So you're quite correct in saying that this certainly made waves up the chain of command.
You mentioned that they had taken Geiger counter readings of where the landing feet of this craft had sat in the forest grass. What was the diameter and the impression of the feet? Were any of those details made available?
They were, and interestingly, and this all now seems a little bit low-tech, but I guess at the time it wasn't, and I suppose sometimes a low-tech solution is actually the most logical one. But a plaster cast was taken. What they did is they poured plaster of Paris, I think, into one of these indentations so that they could get a kind of model of what the leg of this thing looked like. So again, that evidence went up the chain of command and formed part of, I guess, the official case file.
Well, my research and PhD is on spectroscopy, long-wave radiation spectroscopy, but part of my instrumental analysis training was in nuclear spectroscopy or radiochemistry. And I do see a lot of people, especially in oil and gas exploration, they use Geiger counters still today. And it does detect the presence of a scintillation, but now we try to use spectroscopy as much as we can. We use a sodium iodide crystal, which hooked to the right electronics and right program can tell you what species it is that's giving off that scintillation, not just the fact that there's a non-specific scintillation. And I'm putting this out on the radio globally so that in the future, maybe people can get their hands on this kind of equipment when they go and investigate a site. It would be nice to know what element it is that's giving off the radiation, and we would be able to identify that if it was on the periodic chart. We might even be able to determine whether it was terrestrial or extraterrestrial, because every radioisotope that's been generated, at least in this world, can be traced to a reactor and gives off a unique signature.
Sure. Now, again, the records on the Ministry of Defense's website, the assessment of the radiation readings, is just pretty one-dimensional. It just simply says seems significantly higher than we would expect, and it gives the figures. But there's no, correct me if I'm lapsing into the wrong language, but there's no speculation about half-life or elements or any of the more detailed analysis that you would expect and hope to see.
Yep, I would hope to see that.
But I think partly that's because this wasn't followed up as thoroughly as it might have been, and part of that, ironically, is just, I think, a jurisdictional issue. I think there was some confusion over whether the United States Air Force or the Ministry of Defense had the lead on this. So I think each organization was doing something, but maybe assuming the other was taking the lead.
That makes complete sense.
Probably from your own military service, you'll have come across those sorts of situations before.
Oh, absolutely. I was on a base where we had Strategic Air Command and Missile Command on the same base, so there was even territory between those two commands.
I know exactly where you're coming from. I've seen it myself many, many times.
You know, and I guess this program is leading up to something that's just been on my mind. It's probably one of the reasons why I have an open call on this program for anyone with with solid UFO evidence is my feeling, and I guess as a scientist I have a hard time trusting them very much, but I kind of feel like a lot of this is beginning to crescendo, that since we have had two world wars and we have used and tested nuclear weapons, which create electromagnetic pulses that are, at least ostensibly, are felt in multiple dimensions, we have certainly attracted the attention of those who might have been visiting this planet for a long, long time, or may live on this planet just in a different plane of technology than we do. I kind of feel like we're getting very close to what I term global first contact, where we are about to make a leap as a society from rumors and innuendos and blurry pictures and sketches to a meeting between our race at our present level of technology and another race. Do you, I'm not going to ask you about your personal feelings unless you want to share them, but do you feel the evidence is pointing toward that as well?
I wouldn't disagree with any of that. I feel that we're building up a momentum, and that we'll soon reach, again, I guess, what you might call a sort of critical mass on this. I think one of the interesting things in all of this is the SETI program. And I know that search for extraterrestrial intelligence is not necessarily popular with many in the UFO field, but I think perhaps that's because they're in competition with each other. Perhaps it's like the turf war we were just talking about.
Yeah, we all fight for government funding, I guess.
Yes, but I feel that using radio astronomy to listen out for signals, there is a sort of truism here that either there are civilizations elsewhere in the universe, or there aren't. And either there are intelligent civilizations that exist or have existed, or there aren't. And if there are, you would expect them to go through a stage. It doesn't necessarily mean that that stage lasts long, but a stage where they use radio, just because it's fairly obvious science, which is there to be discovered. And if there are signals there, and of course we've been a detectable civilization for a while now through our radio and television broadcasts, yeah, we are a detectable civilization, and there's a bubble of that around the Earth, 60, 70, 80 light years or whatever it is, and expanding at the speed of light. Now, if there are signals out there, we'll find them. And I just look at two things. I look at the sensitivity and power of these radio telescopes, and I look at the computer processing power to interpret the data. And the rise of these two factors is building up to the point where I think you would almost say that if there are signals, say, within the Milky Way, this equipment should be able to find them. And it should be able to find them really within a very short space of years from now. So I get the feeling that SETI might beat ufology to the punch here. But I think inevitably, when that signal is detected, and I think it is a when and not an if, I think people will talk about the day we find, that they'll talk about the days when we didn't know whether or not it was just us, and then the day that we all found out that we weren't alone.
I think that's going to be very interesting. Better myself. So that being said, having the former position that you've had, and rubbing shoulders and having lunch with people that you've had lunch with, has the Ministry of Defense's official line on UFOs changed over the years?
Nope, it's been almost universally the same. And again, there's a statement of policy on the MOD's website, and it says essentially that that we look at UFOs only to see whether there's evidence of anything of any defense significance. Mm-hmm. That to date, we are not aware of any proof of an extraterrestrial reality. But the interesting point, and I suppose the only position that you really could have, is that the department corporately remains open-minded about the possibilities. And that's an interesting statement for a government to make on its website, but it's there. It's in the policy statement.
Well, I know,
and that actually hasn't changed since about 1950.
Yeah, I was going to say, it sounds kind of dated. Mm. You know, in this country, at least, we have many private, ostensibly private organizations that exist solely on government grants for various kinds of research. Some of them are out there and practicing technology exchange like Sandia Labs, and some of them, as a general public, we don't even know if they really exist. We call them black projects. But many people in our country, and maybe in yours as well, believe that that governments have in fact recovered alien aircraft or alien technology, and that they have reverse engineered some of that technology, and that although some claim that we can actually fly like they do, maybe we can communicate like they do, but there are a lot bigger implications than just the fact that maybe our government's trading with aliens. There is this realization that there is a source of energy that's probably clean and powerful and inexpensive that's not being shared with the general public. It is being kept by governments specifically because of that statement of policy that you just mentioned. The funding, the attention, the classification of UFOs and alien technology is specifically filtered through the goggles of defense.
Yes. I mean, these are very, very difficult issues, and I'm certainly aware of all the theories, and I've read, of course, Colonel Philip Corso's book, where he talks about technology from the Roswell crash being seeded gradually into industry through various big corporations. And I know that he's spoken about everything from the transistor through to Kevlar and night vision goggles. It's been technology has been back engineered from the Roswell crash and other such incidents. The honest answer again is I don't know. I haven't seen anything, certainly in my government service, that would validate that. Of course, I can't rule out those allegations, but again, it's nothing that I've seen any official documents on, or even anything that I've gotten any hints in Britain that we're involved in. Now, of course, if there is technology like that out there, my own personal hope is that, of course, we adopt it and use it as quickly as possible, because I think climate change is a massive issue that affects every single person on this planet, and indeed affects our very existence and survival on the planet. And the thought that we might be close to this so-called tipping point and the sort of runaway greenhouse effect that we might see means that this is technology, if it exists, that we should be using as soon as possible. And the other point is, of course, our coal and oil and gas will run out probably within our lifetimes, if not within the lifetimes of our children and grandchildren, but an extraordinarily short space of time in human history.
Well, many people feel like the sooner the better might be a nice way of saving the planet. But I also have to stress, I guess, you know, coming from a military background as well, and what science I do have under my belt, and I do know that all of the money for great research comes from government grants. Now, you know, my money came from oil and gas exploration because my technology was good for exploring for that kind of stuff. But in the area of energy, it almost always is funded by military budgets, whether it's radar, radio, or nuclear, or solar, or hydrogen power. There's always the question, can it be used as a weapon? And
yeah.
I guess, sure, they look at it as an offensive thing, but we also look at it as a defensive thing. If it's too easy to get your hands on, or the wrong people get their hands on it, then you've got a rogue nation with a, you know, insurmountable weapon that we don't have a defense against. And I the only reason I make this statement is I see and hear from your report here that's the posture that our governments have had for 50 or 60 years, that, you know, we don't like our bases being flown over at will. We like to feel like we're secure and safe and in control, and when a 6,000-ton flying triangle comes meandering over an airbase and then shoots off at high speed, we feel kind of vulnerable.
It's a scary thought that we may not be at the top of the food chain, as we've always liked to think we are.
I'd like to not think that I am food.
That's
interesting,
another
analogy.
Disturbing thought in itself. But, you know, the other interesting point, I mean, certainly one can speculate about energy sources here. The other interesting point is, of course, the secret of interstellar travel. And if I can perhaps adopt, as you would expect, the government and military mindset here for a moment, I would say, and I know this is a mindset that might not be too popular in some quarters, but I can well understand the thinking that the power on Earth that develops and is able to deploy interstellar technology will be the dominant force on this planet for the next 10,000 years or longer.
Well, it sounds to me like we have more than one visitor from more than one source, so there may be many, many advanced civilizations out there.
I'm sure there are, and indeed this is a fairly common belief now in mainstream science. Now, mainstream science does not generally believe that those civilizations are visiting us, but, well, maybe they're halfway there in terms of the mindset that they need to adopt. But it's, to me, what is most intriguing about the UFO phenomenon is the possibility of developing some of this technology in terms of the avionics, the aerodynamics, and, of course, critically, the propulsion system. And why are we talking about going to the moon again and Mars if there's interstellar technology out there? We should be talking about a star mission. Interestingly, of course, NASA admit quite, you know, publicly that a star mission is their long-term goal. But they don't talk, of course, about faster-than-light travel.
Well, there is some discussion of that. I know Sandia Labs is experimenting with what has been reported to be a dimensional motor. And the statement from the reporter was that if it is successful, it would reduce the travel time from Earth to Mars to 3 hours, and the travel time from Earth to the nearest star system to 8 days, which would be not like anything we've seen before. I think the fastest speed that we have enjoyed in space is about 76,000 miles an hour, and that was an unmanned craft. I think just recently we launched a 36,000 mile an hour craft, and that's headed out to Mars. But
I think you'll see publicly is talk about sublight travel. But interestingly, even there, there was some interesting theoretical work being done at JPL a few years back, I think by Stephanie Leifer, who was talking about antimatter annihilation propulsion and fission propulsion systems.
And even laser propulsion.
Yes, but again, I think there was there was talk of star missions and reasonable sublight drives, but there was nothing publicly about faster than light travel.
I read a paper about a year ago about an ion drive engine that existed in the days of Eisenhower that would have been capable of achieving 0.2 light speed, which is that's pretty fast.
Yes, I think that I think the JPL work was looking at sort of 0.2, 0.3 of light.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm one of the things that makes sense is that it's not feasible for a biological being to jump into a metal can at some other star system and ride at whatever speed to get here. The fact that we're radiologically interesting isn't going to be available to them for a number of years yet, and then even traveling at the speed of light, it would take them 60 or 70 years to get here. There has to be a different way of traveling, and it's sort of supported by the idea that all of these craft seem to just appear on the radar screen. They don't come in from the coast and travel across six states, even at 10,000 miles an hour, and then show up. They just sort of rise up out of the woods, and they're there. The fact that a craft that size, with that brightness, could appear at night in between two Air Force bases time, I guess it was around 1980, we had quite sophisticated sensing systems at that time, especially on Air Force bases. I find that besides stealth, they've got to have a way to travel that we don't understand yet.
Yes, and part of the story here, I mean, we spoke earlier in the show about radar. At the time this incident was happening, a call went out to a nearby British radar establishment, and the call was, do you have anything on your screens? And the person on duty looked, and for just about two or three sweeps of the radar, there was a blip right over the base, and then nothing. It faded out.
Why do you think the first operator would have asked the second, or do you see anything?
Well, no, it was somebody at Bentwaters Woodbridge who was actually seeing the UFO.
Oh, I see.
He wanted confirmation. He said, are you tracking anything? And the operator said, well, there's an uncorrelated target over your position. And then, as I say, about two or three sweeps later, he said, no, it's gone.
But there was still visual contact.
The radar operator saw something very briefly. But the other interesting thing, and again, conspiracy theorists have read a lot into this, but you'll know from your own military service, I'm sure, that most things that look like conspiracy are just bureaucracy or
yeah.
or cock-up or whatever.
Well, everybody's worried about their promotion and their what we call an airman's performance rating, APR. We don't want anything like that on our record.
Yes, it's like if something like that's going to happen, please let it be not on my watch.
Exactly. Let it happen on someone else's watch so I can criticize them. Well, interestingly enough, though, there seems to be, at high level, more knowledge than the public knows, or even people at your level in the Ministry of Defense knew, because I believe that Baroness Thatcher had an incident where she was questioned, after she was Prime Minister, former Prime Minister, was questioned about UFOs. Do you remember what her response was?
Yes, indeed. One of the several books on the Rendlesham Forest incident is written by a good friend of mine, Georgina Bruni. Now, Georgina Bruni is not really a sort of conventional UFO researcher. She's a businesswoman who has many, many friends in the worlds of politics and diplomacy and the military. And she attends a lot of fairly high-powered diplomatic functions at embassies here in London. And she was, I think, in 1997, I think it was, attending a charity fundraising event where the guest of honour was Baroness Thatcher, the former Prime Minister. And Georgina was writing her book on the Rendlesham Forest case, and she approached Baroness Thatcher and spoke to her briefly about UFOs more generally and about the Rendlesham incident. And she asked the Baroness for her response, and Baroness Thatcher looked a bit disconcerted by all this, and she said, UFOs, she said, UFOs, you must get your facts right, and you can't tell the people. And Georgina was absolutely taken aback by this, because she'd been expecting just a sort of no comment,
right,
or a dismissal. But she said, what do you mean you can't tell the people? But Thatcher simply repeated it, just word for word. She didn't elaborate. She just repeated again, you must have your facts and you can't people. And that was the end of the conversation. So, of course, Georgina's book on the Rendlesham Forest incident is called You Can't Tell the People. But Georgina did, I have to say, a fantastic job in that book, because she spoke to just about all of the witnesses to the Rendlesham Forest incident, all the people that had seen the landed craft on the first night, the people who had been out with Charles Holt on the second night. She was the first person to speak to the base commander, General Gordon Williams, about this. She was the first person, I think, to track down the documentation on this and the fact that General Gabriel, CNC Yousafi, had flown in specially to take possession of this evidence.
And what's the name of her book?
It's called You Can't Tell the People, after Baroness Thatcher's quote.
Wow.
And it really is, I have to say, of all the books I've read on UFOs, in terms of just straight documentation of, well, this is this person and this is his story, just in terms of putting the information into the public domain, it's really one of the best books on the subject that I've read.
Well, that statement sort of embodies the official line that we get from our officials as well. I recently spoke to someone who had the opportunity to present one question to Vice President Dick Cheney, and he asked a similar question. Basically, has the president been briefed on UFOs? And as Dick Cheney has such experience in diplomatic circles, he just turned to him and said, yes, the president has been briefed. And that was the end of that.
Yeah. Well, I had a very interesting kind of hint of something maybe here in Britain, where a very senior officer was asked, you know, what's your view on the whole UFO phenomenon? And this was put to him by a very, very close friend. And he said, don't ask me that. And he said, well, what do you mean? He said, and he said, well, I'm your friend, he said, and I won't lie to you. He said, but I'm not going to answer you either. So he said, don't ask me that.
How about that?
It's interesting. It's things like that which are infuriating in a sense, because, of course, I spent 3 years doing this as my job, and if there is information out there, I feel frustrated that I wasn't privy to it. But again, well, I should say that I was comparatively junior at the time, so not that necessarily has anything to do with the need to know. But inevitably, it's frustrating.
Well, knowing what you know now and not having the liabilities of being a commissioner in the Ministry of Defense, how would you go about conducting your investigation now?
Well, I should say I am still at I do still work for the ministry, but I'm not on the UFO project anymore.
I see.
The honest answer is that I probably wouldn't do it too much differently from the way I did it at the time, because, again, as I think I said earlier, in a way, the mechanics of how you do an investigation really don't change. You simply have to get the best information you can from the witness and then try to corroborate that with what you know. And, I mean, just to talk you through how I did an investigation, yes, number one is there would be either a letter or a phone call or a signal, if it came via the military, with all this information. And it was recorded pretty much in a standard format, and again, the format which Project Blue Book used, dating right back to the 40s and the 50s in America. But yeah, you would get the best information you could, and then you would say, right, where did it happen? When did it happen? What can I find out about what might have been happening there at the time? So you would look at flight paths, you would look at whether there were any military exercises taking place, you would look for weather balloon launches, airships, satellites, you would look at the astronomical data, any particularly brightly visible stars or planets, meteors, fireballs. You'd check the radar. Of course, if you had a photo or video, you'd get it analyzed and get the image enhanced. And at the end of the day, you would try and make a judgment call. You would say, okay, knowing what I know about this sighting, the credibility and reliability of the witness, the other information that I've been able to ascertain, what do I think this was? And about 80% of the time, both me and my predecessors were able to probably assign an explanation with a fairly high degree of certainty that it was a misidentification of something conventional. So 80% of the time it would be aircraft lights, weather balloons, satellites, meteors, whatever. 15% of the time, insufficient data to make a meaningful analysis and estimate of what it was, and 5% unknown. And of course, that infuriating 5% that you really want to nail down.
Right, and you would put the Rendlesham sighting in that 5%?
Oh, absolutely, yes.
It's in the 1% if we definitely know.
It's Rendlesham is definitely the best evidence in the UK of something with a non-conventional explanation.
Well, now there's a question I can't help but ask you, because you're in Britain, and I was over there in July, and shortly after I left, one of these occurred, and recently I had Lucy Pringle on the program, and she's, as you know, a great crop circle investigator. As a member of the Ministry of Defense, do you or did you see a lot of information come in on crop circles?
I kept what in the UK we call a watching brief on this. So do you use that expression? I had a watching brief, which basically means, well, I kept an eye on the whole thing, but it wasn't formally in my terms of reference. And in a sense, that is the same for an awful lot of strange phenomena. You can't run a UFO project without finding yourself on the receiving end of all sorts of weird and wonderful stuff, because people will see strange things and have strange ideas, and if those end up anywhere, if you have a UFO project, they'll end up, that's where they'll go, because there's really nowhere else for them to go. The Ministry of Defense got drawn into the UFO, got drawn into the crop circle mystery, again, almost by accident. At first, a farmer over whose land military helicopters exercised and occasionally landed with his permission, found some strange markings in his crops, and he phoned up to complain. He said, "Your helicopters have been making these strange patterns in my crops. What's going on?" So the report actually found its way to one of my predecessors, because it was like, well, something strange has happened. I will send it to the UFO project. They'll have a look at it. They'll sort it out. So that's how it came. There wasn't any suggestion that these circles had been made by a UFO. The farmer had simply believed it was low-flying helicopters creating these patterns from the downwash from their rotor blades. Now, we proved that that wasn't possible, and that's kind of how we got into it. So I kept an eye on this, and I received reports and things, but I wasn't really able to do the sorts of things that had I had this formally in my terms of reference, I would have been able to do, which would have, of course, have involved taking soil samples from within the formation and then from without the formation as a control, and similarly the crop itself, a corn from within a formation and again as a control from the same field but outside the formation, and do a proper scientific analysis. These were things that really weren't within the terms of reference, but yes, I inevitably became involved in the whole thing, and I have to say, I'm probably quite skeptical about the intricate patterns. I'm more inclined to believe that the straight circles are probably some sort of meteorological phenomenon involving whirlwinds or wind vortices or some such phenomenon. But I'm afraid I'm going to have to be a bit of a party pooper on the really complex pictograms, because my belief on those is that those are made by people.
Yeah, I have a tendency, I'm kind of neutral on it. I've interviewed quite a few people, not the least of which is Ed and Chris Sherwood, who are expert investigators, and I also exchanged some mail with a person in your neck of the woods that has been incarcerated for hoaxing crop circles, and he had a lot of good information. We haven't been able to get him on the program yet, but we're seeking that opportunity. They're fascinating. I think the patterns are extremely complex, and the conditions under which they appear seem to be almost impossible, which I think makes it that much more intriguing for a hoaxer to try to pull off. I was outside of Bowling Green, Kentucky, and there was a stand of green wheat, and we'd had a windstorm, and I believe there was a tornado that touched down, but not in this area, but there were a lot of really strange winds that night, and the next day in the wheat there was not a geometric pattern, but there was definitely a pattern of laid down wheat, and I looked at it, and it seemed very strange, and I stopped, and I asked the farmer, what causes that? And he said it was where, when he was applying the nitrogen or the fertilizer to his field before he planted, that's the overlap where the soil, it's over-fertilized. And when the wheat comes up, the stalks are weak. They're actually swollen with an extra node or two. And if they're exposed to wind, they just lay over.
Right, that's interesting.
I thought that was a pretty neat explanation, even though the pattern wasn't very pleasing to look at. It did seem very similar the way it had laid down. And there was a lot of rain that night, so it would have been impossible. And we don't have the little roads through the wheat like you do in your country. The way it's put down here, it's sown in with the soil, and there's no rows or anything. It grows up like grass. So nothing can move out there, not even a deer, without leaving some kind
right.
of trail through the grass.
Right, yeah, because that's interesting. But, I mean, yes, what I would have, if it had been formally within my terms of reference, I guess, one of the things that I would have done is perhaps authorized a surveillance operation and perhaps packaged it as a, a military exercise whereby people would have kept watch on some of these fields where some of these patterns appear most regularly with night vision goggles and other sensing equipment to see if we could capture anything. But that was aspirational. Unfortunately, it wasn't something I got to do.
Well, that's kind of the frustration we have here in this country, and we call it access. A lot of us are enthusiasts, but we're not professional scientists and don't have access to, first of all, equipment like that, and second of all, we don't have access to government officials who would be filtering or at least receiving as some kind of conduit all of these reports. So even though the Freedom of Information Act is there, it's kind of like surfing the Internet. If you don't know exactly what document on which day you're looking for, it's not like send me everything you have on UFOs. You really need to know what you're looking for.
Exactly, yes. And the best place to hide a book is in a library.
Yes. Well, another hour in the can. Next hour, we are going to venture into perhaps a more emotional part of UFOs. UFOs have what we believe are extraterrestrials or aliens in them, and one of the things that we ask ourselves all the time is, why are they here? And the next hour we're going to go into perhaps some of that interaction between humans known as abductions and maybe even animal mutilation. So we'll get into a little bit more detail on that in our last hour. Again, we'll take about a 6-minute break and let you get a drink of water or take a break, and we'll be back right at the top of the hour. Have you bought inkjet cartridges for your printer lately? Well, I can tell you, I paid $80 to replace the color and black cartridges at a national retail store that will remain unnamed, but no more. Now I do all my shopping for inkjet materials at 123 Inkjets. I bought a color cartridge for less than $20, got free shipping, and I got a chance at winning a free printer. I just bought a black cartridge for that same printer for less than $13, free shipping. So forget about those high prices for inkjet cartridges. Just click on the 123 Inkjet sign at X Squared Radio, that's x2-radio.com, and start saving money. Right now, the incredible April special sale is in full swing. With each purchase, you get a chance to win a free printer, and they're giving away 5 printers a day. So your odds are getting better. Don't forget to check out their other printer supplies at 123 Inkjets at X Squared Radio. With only a few missions left, the space shuttle fleet will soon be decommissioned. This spacecraft has carried the entire planet into the next millennia with dozens of satellites, probes, and experiments. It has inspired us all. I never got a chance to go to Florida and watch a launch. I doubt I will make it down there for any of the few launches left. I'm just too busy with other things, just like you are. Now, that's why I like to shop at the Space Store. I have a model of the Space Shuttle Orbiter that's over 25 inches tall in my library. Visitors always stop and comment how fantastic the detail is. I want to keep the memory of this great program alive for my sons and for myself because it represents the best efforts of the human race. And you can too by clicking the Space Store sign at X Squared Radio. They have great stuff for kids of all sizes, even ones big as me. If you've got a birthday or a holiday coming up, just visit the Space Store at X Squared Radio. Who knows? You just might inspire the next generation of space explorers. And hey, we also know from our emails that there are many listeners out there in the business of education. Without their hard work and dedication to the students of the world, there wouldn't be any scientists. We wouldn't have a space program, no cures for disease, no new research into cleaner sources of energy. That's why we at X Squared Radio are proud to welcome our new affiliate, the academic superstore. They have every supply that teachers, professors, and researchers might need at rock-bottom prices. Software like AutoCAD, Minitab if you're into statistics like I am, Dreamweaver if you're into web development, and all kinds of general software at huge educational discounts. They also have those neat gadgets, iPod accessories and models that make educating fun and help students grasp those concepts at the edge of their current imagination. Please visit the Academic Superstore at X Squared Radio. And I also want to tell you about, I know how much you like gadgets and neat instruments. I do. And you also know that the weather is getting more and more unpredictable. It's kind of nice to know what it's doing for yourself. I call it my AccuWindow forecast. Well, I found a store that has everything for the outdoor enthusiast and the neatest gadgets for informing you about the weather. It's called Wind and Weather, and it's the store where you can find the highest quality gifts and gear for the person who loves the outdoors. Compasses, barometers, sundials, fountains, and all kinds of special gear for extreme conditions by companies like Oregon Scientific, La Crosse, and Rainwise. They're bringing the best of all things weather to you in one spot. So browse the Wind and Weather store at X Squared Radio. We will take a short 43-second musical break, and we will be back with our guest, Nick Pope. I'm Brooks Agnew. And welcome back, Earth Explorers, to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. In here, the results are always positive. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew, and our guest tonight is Nick Pope, Commissioner with the Ministry of Defense in Britain. We have been talking about UFOs, UFO sightings, investigations, all kinds of evidence. Recently, we talked about crop circles. But one can hardly talk about UFOs very long before the question comes up, why are they here? One of those reasons began surfacing decades ago, but only now is really getting serious consideration. That is the subject of alien abductions. In Britain, the National Council for Hypnotherapy issued a landmark policy statement concerning this exact subject. They state, alien abduction clients, they call them AACs, are to be treated with the same respect and courtesy as any other client. Regression techniques that should be utilized with AACs should follow these guidelines. A, non-directive, B, non-leading, and C, preferably indirect, of course. Mental health professionals are cautioned against a syndrome known as false memory syndrome and against corroborating these incidents. But you have a contact in this industry, do you not, Nick?
I do, yes. A man called David Howard, who has worked with a number of abductees that I've referred him to, and some of whom who are now contacting him direct. And he was really the driving force behind that statement that you mentioned. He and I had been corresponding, and we'd met, and we felt there was a bit of a vacuum. We felt everyone had an opinion about using regression hypnosis on abductees, whether it was a skeptical opinion or whether it was an opinion that this was a good thing. But there were no guidelines. So he thought that there should be, and we sat down and thrashed them out really between the two of us. And he was very much the driving force in getting those guidelines adopted by the National Council for Hypnotherapy. And I believe it's a situation which is really unique in the world, that the governing body that looks after the use of hypnotherapy has taken a formal position on alien abductions, and I think it's commendable.
Well, you know, this is so interesting and so powerful. I think I'd like to open up the phone lines, too, just in case we have people who are listening who might have had an experience like this. Our toll-free number is 888-268-4313 anywhere in North America. That's 888-268-4313. Call in toll-free. I have a friend whose name is Granville Angel, and he is a psychologist, been practicing, licensed for many decades, and he related a story to me. We were actually attending a convention, and I had a chance to interview him, and he said that, you know, for a long time he just dealt with the ordinary things, you know, loss and the ordinary things that a psychologist would deal with. And one day he had a case from a person who was suffering from nightmares, and he is a hypnotherapist, and he took them, I guess, through what you're calling this regression therapy. And this person related an incident where she felt like she had been abducted and taken up into a spacecraft and had been probed and poked. And in fact, she did have a scar, a surgical scar, even though she claimed she had never had any surgery. Well, he treated her, and I guess over a period of time, as most patients do when they regain their health, they just go back into society. But then he had another, and then another. And then he, because of how much it interested him and the frequency with which it seemed like they were there and the similarity in their stories, he advertised for people that maybe have had these kinds of nightmares, and he was deluged. I don't know how old he is. I guess he's a little younger than I am, but I visited his house. He doesn't live very far from me. And as we were walking through, I asked him, how many people have you talked to? And he had spoken to over 12,000 people. And he said in his research in professional journals, in the last 10 years alone, there have been over 125,000 reported cases in the United States. And he said it's probably much more than that. Just like you mentioned earlier, data doesn't get correlated, it doesn't get cataloged or put into databases like that. But it appears as though this has been going on a long, long time.
Sure. That statistic is quite astounding. I mean, I've personally, I guess, looked into about 100 cases here in the UK. Of course, I've heard many, many more stories that I've simply not had the time or resources to look into. But it is extraordinary. But I suppose, as you said at the end of the last hour, if these UFOs are here, well, they've got to be here for a reason. They've got to be doing something. And certainly there does seem to be some strong evidence to suggest that there is interaction. After all, I guess, without any degree of arrogance, I suppose we can say that one of the most interesting things on planet Earth is us. Whether we're a sort of a resource or whether we're a subject of study, I don't know. But as many people have said in UFOs, never mind the UFO, what about the driver?
Well, we have both agreed, and we've interviewed many people, you and I, and we, if you ask the question, do you believe in UFOs, you're certainly going to get, you know, a sideways look. Some people will jump right on it, and others will say, well, who's watching if I tell you? But when someone comes up to you and says, I was abducted by aliens, and they implanted something in me, or they took a tissue sample from me, or then you really get the strange looks. So how is the subject of alien abductions treated by the Ministry of Defense?
I think that people are generally pretty reluctant to make reports to the Ministry of Defense. Certainly when I was there, I really only received about half a dozen. Most of the reports that I've had, and really most of the abductees who I've worked with, have been people who contacted me after I left that particular tour of duty. And they've been people who've come to me in a private capacity after I spoke out and started writing about these issues. I think that the fear of ridicule kicks in. And also, of course, many of the people who have had these strange experiences actually believe that the government are, shall we say, at the very least, implicated to some extent. So there's a natural reluctance to report to somebody who they think already knows about it and is kind of involved in covering it up.
Well, what does that mean?
Well, I simply think there is a great mistrust on the part of people who've had these experiences of the government. They believe that either the MOD has done a deal with the extraterrestrials, and you know the theories are out there in the literature, exchanges of technology given against a free hand to abduct people. These are the sorts of things that people believe, and these are the sorts of I no position on this myself, but I'm simply saying this is what a lot of people out there believe, and I've heard it from them. I've heard abductees say, why should I report to the MOD? They already know about this. You are the people who are responsible for this. You're involved. So that's why the Ministry of Defense doesn't get many alien abduction reports.
Well,
I get them in a private capacity, and many, many other people here do.
I have heard that governments are so interested in advanced technology that they would make such a deal as long as the individuals that are abducted are on the same level as the homeless. We're not going to abduct presidents, and we're not going to abduct military people, I've heard of read reports of people disappearing off the decks of cruise ships in the middle of the ocean, and all kinds of different kinds of reports. But it's not the people that disappear; it's the people that disappear and then come back, either with there are several classifications. I really don't even know where to begin. Women who say that they have had eggs removed from them, or have given birth on a spacecraft in space and then returned to Earth without the baby, and I've heard of men having body parts removed, and then there's the just superb reporting about animal mutilations. Do you have animal mutilations in Britain as well?
Yes. I looked into a few cases of that, but they were generally, not least for insurance purposes, they were generally attributed to attacks from either dogs or indeed big cats. And there's a separate mystery here in the UK, where we don't have indigenous big cat populations such as cougars or anything like that, but it's consistently been alleged that there is a wild population, perhaps escaped from zoos or illegal private collections of big cats, such as pumas and lynxes and leopards and such like. And every time we have a animal mutilation, which is generally sheep here and perhaps the odd horse and cow, but these things are attributed to either dogs or big cats. So any suggestion that UFOs are responsible tends to be marginalized and just something which private researchers look into. But there are certainly strange animal deaths here. Well, there's no doubt about it.
I would think it'd be kind of strange to think that you could get insurance for your animal to be attacked by cats that don't exist.
Yes.
You can't get insurance to protect your animals against UFO mutilation.
Well, you can't get that. You have to pretty much attribute everything for insurance claims. You have to pretty much attribute everything to a dog.
Well, I know. I have to quote Linda Moulton Howe. I think she's just the hardest working science reporter on the planet, and I just think the world of her. We've communicated briefly from time to time over the years, and I just think she's the hard working, and she never stops and always produces the best stuff. And
yes, indeed.
She's kind of the leader in correlating and reporting animal mutilations, but in looking at the evidence, at least here in this country, it looks like I have a degree in biology, but I'm not a biologist. But it does look as though epithelial areas of these animals are removed, like tongues and inner linings of the mouth and the rectum and all the blood, of course, which would be exactly the cells and exactly the medium that you would need if you were going to culture something. And you needed a ready source of genetic material. I can only speculate why it's being done, but I can, as a scientist, objectively look at the data and say when I see an 800-pound animal dropped through 35-foot trees to the ground and it's missing some of its body parts and there's no tire tracks or animal tracks or human tracks to and from this area, and there are literally broken branches underneath the animal, it's a pretty safe bet that the animal was dropped from the sky.
Yes. I mean, of course, I can't overstate here in the UK. I don't know what the position is in the States, but the farming communities here always exist very, very close to the poverty line. So to lose any animal in any circumstances is potentially disastrous financially. So you simply have to have any strange death attributed to an attack by a dog off the lead. Otherwise, you won't get the insurance payment. And I've spoken to both farmers and vets who certainly, I think, suspect some very strange things have been happening, but have conspired to make sure that it'll get written up as a dog attack, because that's the only way the farmer will get the money.
Mm.
And that's unfortunate, because, of course, in terms of investigation, it means that most of these cases will never come to anyone's attention at all.
Well, I certainly don't claim to be the animal mutilation expert. I defer that, but being that we're talking about the subject, I couldn't help but bring it up. But I want to get back to the human abduction. The National Council for Hypnotherapy, I guess we have a similar organization in our country as well, but it does seem, I know they're cautioned against corroborating, but are they cautioned against, you know, databasing even in a anonymous way some of the facts, some of the patterns, and try to see if it is a phenomenon or if it's just mass hysteria or copycatting or, at least in this country, we get, you know, policemen, teachers, farmers, construction workers, business people, all basically saying the same thing.
Yes, I don't think the National Council for Hypnotherapy have really tried to correlate the data that they've got. It's an organization which is really there for its members as a kind of top cover organization. So it tends not to do these big research projects itself. Interestingly, we've had a scientific study in this country done quite recently by a skeptical scientist called Professor Chris French. But it was a proper scientific study along the lines of some work done in the United States by people like Susan Clancy and Richard McNally. And it was an attempt to take a group of abductees and to compare them with a control group of non-abductees that matched in terms of age and gender, and to give them a whole bunch of tests, including standard personality tests, looking for psychopathology, and also looking for some of the claimed differences in abductees that are sometimes reported in terms of psychic ability. The results of the studies are quite interesting. Both Professor French's study here in Britain, and indeed I believe the research done by people like Clancy and McNally in the States, certainly find no evidence of psychopathology. These people, the abductees, people who claim to have these experiences, they're not mad. They're not. Neither are they making it up. It's interesting. Of all the people I work with, I'm very often contacted by television companies, often looking for people to appear on shows talking about this. And there are fees that they're quite happy to pay. So if these abductees were interested in publicity or money, you would expect them to jump at this. Of the 100 people I've worked with, I can think of about 2 or 3 who have any interest in doing any media work. The rest simply don't want to know. They want some answers, but they don't want publicity. They don't want to be on some TV show. So that's interesting.
What answers do you think they're looking for?
A lot of it, I suppose, is almost like, and I'm loath to use this because it's a very loaded phrase, but I'm going to use it anyway. It's almost like a crime victim. I think there's a certain why me. That's a question that I often hear from abductees. Why did this happen to me? Why not somebody else? What is it that I've done? Or what is it about me that made this happen? What do they want? What did they do? Why didn't they level with me? Why didn't they talk to me? Those are the sorts of questions that I've heard.
Were, of the 100 that you are familiar with, did they live in a more rural setting where they were kind of like out on the farm or out on the back porch alone and saw a light and had 3 or 4 hours disappear? And
no, it's a remarkable cross-section of people. Men, women, old people, young people. It's very difficult to, I mean, people who live in rural areas, people who live in cities. I have an abduction case that took place involving somebody who was driving a car at the time in a major city. In fact, I had a very interesting case involving somebody who had about 3.5 hours of missing time. They saw what they thought was a small aircraft. They were driving down a major road, one of our big freeways. There were 2 people in the car. One of them spotted something and said, "Hey, look at that strange aircraft." Next thing they knew, It was 3.5 hours later, and they were in the outer edges of the city that they'd been driving to, and they had no memory of how they'd gotten there and what had just happened, and they nearly crashed the car as a result of the shock of this.
And they were actually put back in the car.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
My goodness.
There was a sort of disconnect. I had another case involving somebody, a British woman, but somebody who was working in America at the time, who had just pulled off the freeway in Los Angeles, in downtown Los Angeles, had pulled up at at a red light and had an abduction experience right there. So, you know, I've had plenty of cases involving the lonely country road late at night, for sure. But I've also had cases right in the middle of cities. Finding the pattern, finding the connecting factor here is very interesting. I was talking to Professor Chris French about this, and he is, I believe, trying to get a follow-up study done, which is going to try and look at other factors. That there must be something. In a way, the abductees, I think, have the right question, why me? There must be something about these people. What it is, we don't know, but one of the areas I would like to explore is, for example, blood groups. Is there a particular blood group that links these people? If we can find the factor that links these apparently very different people living in different places all around the world, taken in different circumstances, but if we can find the factor, perhaps physiological factor, that links them, I think we're going to make a very important breakthrough. But at the moment, we don't have that
piece
of information.
You haven't collected the data?
Hmm.
I mean, it wouldn't be too hard to find out what blood type they are, but it might go beyond that, because if it was simply blood group...
But you see, people don't ask that question. I'm not aware you think of maybe the major abduction researchers, people like Bud Hopkins and Dave Jacobs and the late Professor John Mack. I'm not sure that they routinely asked, what blood group are you? What if all these people were the same blood group?
That would be remarkable.
But you see, no one's asked. And to me, this is, or at least I'm not aware they've asked.
I would say at least 30% of the health research dollars that have been spent in this country in the last 15 years have been spent on the Human Genome Project. It offers such promise for cures that it can hardly be ignored. But one of the things that has fallen out of it is now we have a fairly good map of the human genome. We see points of origin and also points of genetic engineering that's common in our genetic code, things that would not have occurred naturally. We're 100% convinced that DNA is an engineered molecule. It's not something that would occur in nature. And it's quite possible that certain genetic lines or genetic propensities are what are being sought after by these alien researchers, and not, I mean, I'm trying to think what would motivate a craft to take a risk in a highly populated area on a busy highway where they could be seen by hundreds if not thousands of people, take a highly risky daytime snatch out of a moving vehicle for two individuals. Now, maybe both individuals had 3.5 hours of missing time, but I'd venture to say one of those individuals had a surgical experience and the other did not.
Yes, I think that's pretty much my conclusion too. Other interesting point, and again, I think you touched on it there, is bloodlines. And these experiences do seem to occur certainly within family groups. I have many, many cases where these experiences will straddle generations, and say grandmothers, mothers, and daughters will have these experiences. I had a very, very touching case involving a mother and a son, and the son was sometimes allowed to sleep in the top room in the house, and it was a special treat which he very much looked forward to. But on one occasion, something happened, and the mother had a very strange dream about a whole lot of cats on the roof staring at her with big black eyes. And quite independently, the son turned round and said he didn't want to sleep in that room again. And the mother asked why. And the son said, "If I sleep in that room," he said, "the bad fairies will come and take me away." Now, this is a young child who's had no exposure whatsoever to any material on UFOs and aliens and such like, because his mother had very much protected him from this, even though she believed that she'd had experiences herself, and she'd wanted to kind of deny it and keep it from her son. And then suddenly this remarkable phrase, you know, "the bad fairies will come and take me away," it was quite extraordinary, quite poignant.
Wow. I think one of the cases that Granville shared with me, there was a woman who, and she lived in a rural area, and she was ostensibly abducted off her back porch. She went out to, I think, smoke a cigarette or something like that, and it was about 10 o'clock at night. And the next thing she knew, she was standing in the front yard, and it was 2 o'clock in the morning. And the whole house had gone to sleep, and she was standing outside. She thought maybe that she had just lost track of time and was sleepwalking. She was wearing the same clothes that she was wearing when she went outside to smoke. She wasn't even wearing night clothes. Well, I guess most people would just say, "Well, gee, a blackout or something. I went to sleep or something." But then how Granville got to know her is she came to him with nightmares. It was about maybe 6 months later she started having nightmares where, well, she was just bothered. And in the regression therapy, it turned out that she had been abducted and taken up into a spacecraft, and that she was held, you know, mute. She couldn't speak, but she could, you know, move her eyes and everything, and various activities, and then they brought her back. But it's so interesting that you would say that they would follow bloodlines, because if they're looking for certain genetic traits and they have the patience to work from generation to generation, or if what we suspect by looking at the human genetic code that there has been in history some manipulation, and now they want to look for the results of that manipulation, whether there have been mutations or whether things have worked out the way they thought they would work out, it would make perfect sense. And then there's the other camp that says that maybe their genetic code is beginning to break down because of lack of variety, or maybe the age of their civilization. It may be millions of years old instead of a few hundred thousand years old, maybe our age is, and that they need fresh genetic material to save their race.
Yes, I've certainly come across these theories, and certainly many of the cases that I've looked into have involved the idea of hybridization. And I have a very interesting case, for example, where a woman claimed to have been abducted, and the alien showed her a small listless baby and held it out to her. And she got the impression that the alien was trying to get her to bond with it. And the thought was very much that this was her child.
My goodness.
And people like Bud Hopkins have many, many cases like that. And going back to the point that you made about some sort of genetic program, I believe that Linda Moulton Howe has used the phrase in a in fact, I think this is the title of one of her books, An Alien Harvest. And it's almost this idea that we are a resource, we're a crop, we are something, the human race, our genetic material that's been harvested. Or indeed, in her case, and much of her research about animal mutilations, that again, the material that you talked about, be it blood or be it other organs, is again being harvested. It's a disturbing thought. And again, goes back to the heart of why I say that this is a defense and national security issue. If these things are happening, why are they happening? Well, you know, we want to know that we want to know what's happening to our citizens.
Well, I have a variety of thoughts because at first I classified national defense as not wanting your sovereign airspace flown into without permission, and certainly not craft hovering over your air bases without invitation. But now it sort of brings another dimension to it. If the very populations that we're constituted to defend are being plucked out of their quiet enjoyment of life against their will and either removed completely from this planet or used in some way or another against their will. That seems another dimension.
I won't use the language that was used for obvious reasons, but I'll give you the gist of the story. One abductee got so angry about this that she contacted the Ministry of Defense's UFO project, and she said, "You're the Ministry of Defense," she said, "defend me." She used somewhat stronger language than that, but that was the essence of her point.
Well, then I guess there's two reactions. One is, we don't think you need defending. We think you have a mental problem. And the other is, we've made a deal with the people that that you want us to defend you against. And
the response was far more bizarre than that.
And oh, really?
It's a story that's been turned almost into a bit of a joke here. I think, I don't know if it was this particular abductee or another abductee, but somebody wrote into the Ministry of Defense and made a point about alien abductions. And the reply, not from me, I hasten to add, but from one of my successors on the UFO project, said in a completely straight-laced, neutral way, "Abduction is a criminal offense and is therefore a matter for the police."
Oh, my goodness.
You can imagine, I'm sure, how that was received by the abductee.
Wow. Well, we have opened up a whole other show here. Since I was a little boy, I guess I've always wanted to see a UFO. I fly quite a bit, and I specify to my travel agent that I want the window seat.
So me too.
I can look out the window, and I have been doing so for 40 years, and I haven't seen anything. And now I'm not so sure I want to.
I would love to. Like you, I travel a lot by air. I get on a plane, I guess, at least once a month, either business or travel and pleasure and such like, and I've flown an aircraft myself, I've flown light aircraft, and I've ridden in everything from C-130 Hercs to Boeing 747s, and I always try and get a view of wherever I'm going, but neither in the air nor on the ground have I ever seen a UFO, and in a sense, sometimes I think that's hugely unfair that I ran the UFO project and I've never seen one. I think it's unfair. I think I should get to see one.
Well, there you are.
you know, I don't mean to joke about it, really. I mean, I genuinely would like to see something, not a light in the sky, but something absolutely unequivocal, undeniable, one of these massive triangular-shaped UFOs. You know, one of the interesting cases that I investigated during my tour of duty was another case from 1993 where a UFO flew over a military base, and I was speaking to an Air Force witness about this, and he described a massive triangular-shaped craft flying slowly towards the base, maybe no more than 20 or 30 miles an hour, perhaps just 200 feet up. He said absolutely vast, midway in size between something like a C-130 Hercules transport aircraft and a Boeing 747. He said there was a low-frequency humming sound coming from this craft, one of those sounds that you could actually feel in your chest, rather like
subsonic almost.
Yes, like standing in front of a bass speaker or something like that.
Right.
And he said this thing was firing a narrow beam of light down at the ground, and this beam of light was sweeping backwards and forwards as if it was looking for something in the field just beyond the perimeter fence of the military establishment. And he said suddenly the light beam just flicked off, the UFO hung there for a moment, and it just shot off to the horizon. This guy's in the Air Force, and he sees fast jets all the time. He said this was like maybe 10 times as fast as a military jet.
My goodness.
Interestingly, he said no sonic boom.
In North Carolina, one of the icons of UFO reporting, his name is George Fawcett, he lives not far from me, just recently retired, but I got to meet him several times. In fact, he introduced me one time at a MUFON convention, and he reported that in North Carolina there were three distinct sightings of, and I believe these were large black triangles. He said one was described as being almost 600 feet from corner to corner, and the other two were about 100 feet from corner to corner. Now, that is a big craft. And he also said that they were moving at low altitude, about 300 or 400 feet off the ground. That's certainly below radar. I think something that size would be a little hard to hide, but in the rural area of North Carolina, could probably move pretty easily without being spotted by too many people. But the fact that it shot off at that kind of speed, it just belies some kind of propulsion system that we don't understand.
Yes, and also in terms of the G-forces, of course, that sort of acceleration would generally kill any human occupant. I mean, even wearing a G-suit, the sort of G's implied by that sort of sudden acceleration is very difficult to understand.
I had on this program back in December Dr. Stephen Greer, and I asked him. He was on for an hour, so I fired a lot of questions at him, and we were talking about reverse engineering of UFO technology, and I asked him point blank, does the United States possess craft that can make a right-hand turn at 10,000 miles an hour? And he didn't hesitate. He said, yes, we do.
See, my answer to that is, I don't know. We had an interesting little exchange with the Americans. In fact, after that incident that I've just described to you in 1993, we thought that we'd better, in terms of investigating, see whether some U.S. black project had been operating inadvertently over the U.K. without... giving proper diplomatic clearance and things. So we asked the Americans through the embassy, do you have any craft, vast triangular craft that can go from virtually zero to Mach 8 or 10 or something like that in an instant? And have you been flying it over the UK? And their answer was no. This was through the embassy, so we were on regular sort of Air Force. We went through the air attaché, I recall. Their answer was no, but they had a question for us. And their question was, do you have something like that, and have you been flying it over America? Because we've had sightings like that too. And we just laughed because... the thought that the Americans would think that we had something like that, we just sort of said to ourselves, well, we wish we did.
I would have loved to have heard that exchange. That would make a great movie right there. Well, it certainly sounds like you've lived, at least for a period of your life, like the real-world Fox Mulder, haven't you?
That's what the media here call me. They call me the real Fox Mulder, and some of my colleagues used to, when they saw me walking down the corridor, they would kind of hum or whistle the X-Files theme tune. And at first, I got a bit irritated about this. I thought it was just, trivializing what I believed was very serious work. But then I thought, no, you know, if you can't take a joke,
when that program first came out, the content was so powerful and so similar to what maybe people really have experienced. I think the writers did an excellent job of tapping into that feeling, and it was immensely popular.
Yes, indeed. Chris Carter and all the people on the X-Files had clearly consulted very closely with UFO researchers and witnesses, and they'd done their research, they'd gone out into the literature, and I decided, if you can't beat them, join them. And I've written two science fiction novels myself based on alien invasion to try and... incorporate some of these themes, so I can sympathize and see the funny side of all this as well.
Well, hopefully efforts in your country and my country, not just freedom of information, but even though we don't know enough to know what questions to ask, we as a scientific community sort of exopolitically are going to our government saying, look, we want you to open the hangars, as it were. We want to see the aircraft that crashed at Roswell. We want to see the aircraft that crashed at San Augustine. We want to know what you know. And that feeling is almost universal, even among complete skeptics that I talk to that say that UFOs are just popularized movie stuff and it's mass hysteria, swamp gas, you know, the old arguments. But even those people say that the government knows way more than what they're sharing with us, and we just think that it's time that we graduated and became Earthlings instead of individual nations on this. The consensus, at least in my community, in the physics community, because, you know, scientists, as you know, we pick crumbs with the sparrows. If I didn't do consulting, I wouldn't be able to feed my family, because there's certainly no living in science. But if the money that was being spent trying to maintain borders or fight one war or another were directed to this kind of research, to propulsion and space exploration and alternate energy sources that exist in the solar system or in the galaxy that we could tap into, we could graduate as a people.
Yes, and I think that's the graduation we desperately need on many, many levels. And I think you made a really interesting point there, talking about the global perspective, because I think, again, perhaps going back to something we were saying much earlier in the show, whether it comes through SETI and the detection of a signal through radio astronomy, or whether it comes through some UFO event, there will be a time, I'm sure, in the not-too-distant future when we realize and totally accept that that we're not alone. And for all the conspiracy theories and scare stories about panic in the streets and collapse of economies and things, maybe there's something good to be had out of all of this, and maybe it's an idea that we can put aside some of our religious and racial and political differences and think of ourselves not as black or white or you know, Christian or Muslim, but just think of ourselves as citizens of planet Earth. And perhaps if our default position was thinking of ourselves as citizens of Earth, maybe this planet would be a better place.
I think it would. I think we're done with charging across the frozen tundra with battle axes in hand. I think we're, at least the race once or twice has gotten to this point and not made it. But I think I'm confident, I have a feeling that we can make it this time. We can graduate from this, and we can join the community that seems to have been visiting us for thousands of years. And I, for one, want to, worse than anything. I have to ask you, though, with all of the excitement and the, I know you were thrust upon this, but you look at the things you've been exposed to and the people that you've met and the information you've been privy to, why have you left the UFO project?
Oh, it was simply because it was just a standard tour of duty. So
I see.
Nobody ever serves more than maybe 3 or 4 years on it, and then you either get posted or you get promoted.
Well, maybe the person who has the watch now is going to experience that event that we just talked about, that sort of binary event where before this moment there was some doubt as to whether we were alone in the universe, and now there is no doubt, and everything has changed.
Well, I certainly envy them that. I wish it had happened on my watch, but obviously it didn't. But I hope in some small way, through the work I did then and through the work that I do now in lecturing and broadcasting about this, and I do a lot of media work on this, predominantly in Britain, but also in the States and elsewhere, I hope to have played some small part towards maybe opening people towards some of the possibilities, interesting them in taking a closer look at this.
Well, you know, we here at X Squared Radio, my personal philosophy is everything we do will eventually affect the universe, and I try to do that on purpose. And although it appears we don't have a lot of live listeners tonight, when this archive goes up on the web, it can be viewed by anyone around the planet. And of course, we're doing all the marketing that we can afford to do, because we want people to hear these words, and we want this word to get out. That's why this is a free broadcast. We at BBS Radio Network believe that the truth, if it's put out there, will enlighten people, will expand people, will bring people together, and it may actually result in world peace. At least that's my personal feeling. And if we can graduate as a race, as you say, and put whatever differences we've been carving each other up about for the last 10 centuries aside, and grow and become, you know, join the global or the galactic community, I think I would love to have that happen in my lifetime, certainly in my children's lifetime. And interviews like this, interactions like this between you and I, and I intend to hold you to that meeting sometime this summer. I'll be over there, and I'll let you know plenty of time in advance, and we'll try to get together and see if we can affect the universe again. And I'm sure we'll meet again.
Yeah, that would be great. I've very much enjoyed coming on the show today, and look forward to doing so again and to meeting you and discussing some of these issues. What is it they say? The truth shall set you free, isn't it?
The truth shall set you free. And I know it's almost 1 o'clock in the morning there, so I will let you go. But I appreciate you being on the program, and I will send you a link to the archive. And stay in touch, and I will keep your website posted on our website, and we'll try to send you as much business and much attention as we can. And I appreciate you being on the program. You've been a wonderful guest. And as usual, 3 hours goes by in about an hour.
It does indeed. It certainly hasn't felt like 3 hours. I've very much enjoyed it.
Wow, same here. And I appreciate your appearance. So peace, and have a relaxing time as you try to get a good night's sleep. And we'll talk to you later.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Well, listeners, Earth Explorers, this has been a marvelous show with Nick Pope, former commissioner serving in the Ministry of Defense in charge of UFOs. I want you to remember who you are. Remember that here at X Squared Radio, the results are always positive. And remember, if it's on BBS Radio Network, it's not mainstream. We wish you peace, goodwill, and we'll see you next Sunday night at 5 p.m. Eastern. Good night, Earth Explorers.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others ever. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.